Welcome to Psyched, a podcast about psychiatry that covers everything from the foundational to the cutting edge, from the popular to the weird. Thanks for tuning in.
Hey everybody, this is David Carrion.
This is Jesse Gold.
And this is Psyched, a psychiatry podcast. So today we have Paul Applebaum, the Elizabeth K. Dollard Professor of Psychiatry, Medicine, and Law, and Director, the Division of Law, Ethics, and Psychiatry at Columbia. Dr. Applebaum went to Harvard Medical School and did his residency at Massachusetts Mental Health Center. He is the past president of the American Psychiatric Association and the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law. He is currently chair of the DSM Steering Committee for the APA and of the Sustaining Committee on Ethics of the World Psychiatric Association. Dr. Applebaum, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So you've done a lot of work over the years in the ethics of psychiatry. And we wanted to ask first, sort of, how did you get into that side of things?
Yeah, you know, interestingly, my initial interest was in law and how legal regulation impacted the practice of psychiatry. And I came to see that law represented a codification of one possible ethical position that you could assume about any issue. And in order to understand the broader picture, one had to understand the ethical issues in psychiatry and medicine more broadly. And so that initial interest in the law then led me into a broader interest in ethics.
Would you say psychiatry as a field versus other medical specialties has more interaction with the law?
Psychiatry does have more interaction with the law. We have, for one thing, powers that other physicians rarely exercise, for example, involuntarily committing patients, involuntarily treating patients. We also are frequently called upon in general medical settings to do legally related evaluations, such as decisional capacity to consent to or refuse treatment. And so we seem implicated in the law in a way that's not quite as true for other medical specialties.
And I suppose this is something that is a question that some people who've maybe been out of practice a long time or people who are listening to this who aren't psychiatrists. What does it look like these days to involuntarily commit somebody? I think a lot of people might be having pictures of you know, from film or movies. How has that process changed over your career?
Well, you know, the big changes in this country happened in the 1970s when I was in medical school and residency training. The change was going on. Before that period of time, going back to the beginning of the state hospital system in the second quarter of the 19th century, involuntary commitment was physician-controlled and based on whether the physician perceived the patient to be in need of hospital treatment. That was the standard. That changed in the 1970s as every state in the country altered its law in not much more than a 10-year period to require that patients be either dangerous to themselves in the sense of suicidality, dangerous to other people, or incapable of meeting their basic needs in many states in order to qualify for involuntary hospitalization. And so the potential pool of involuntary committees was markedly narrowed in that decade, and that remains true to today.
And the time frame also shortened, like the amount of time someone could be put in?
Yeah, there were a slew of procedural changes that accompanied the change in the standard, including much shorter periods of emergency hospitalization, which at one point, depending on your state, could have gone on for 10 or 20 days. Typically these days it's 3 to 5 days at most. Requirements for periodic rehearings after relatively shorter periods of time than was true in the past, the right to be represented by an attorney, to have a hearing, to call witnesses. All of these things, although they may have existed partially before the 1970s, became standard across the country in the 1970s.
It's one of the things that's really interesting to me. I think that I liked what you said about the difference between law representing one ethical perspective on the world, and then I've had for a lot of people I've talked to and colleagues, sort of the law have this sort of didactic purpose, and the what is the law becomes what is ethical, and moving in the other direction. But I guess I'm curious about how do you go from one set of standards to an entirely different set of standards, that it's the doctor making the decision versus it's the court making the decision. I mean, that must have been a fascinating atmosphere to do medical school in.
Well, I think it was a very interesting period of time in American history in general. The ferment begins in the 1960s, and as part of the distrust of authorities of all kinds, psychiatry was encompassed in that aura of distrust, as part of the concern that legislators had about the growing size of state hospital systems and their cost. There was an economic factor that came into play as well. And in the wake of the civil rights revolution in the courts in the 1950s, there were new legal tools that legal advocates could use to argue for greater protections for people with mental illnesses. And when you put all of those together, you ended up with the potential for a sea change, which is actually what occurred in a brief period of time. So I see myself as fortunate to have been in training during that era, but the era shaped what I did. Had I come along 10 years later, when much of this was already fully established, the area of law and ethics might not have seemed as exciting to me.
Well, I guess that's another question. I mean, the issues then were, who can legally detain a patient or have who can make these decisions. What are some of the things right now? I mean, you continue to do work. What are some of the hot issues, some of the important questions that facing psychiatry and the law or psychiatry and ethics today?
Many of the legal issues in our field have been reasonably well settled over the last several decades. That's not to say there might not be another era of change looming, but it is to say that we're, for the most part, in a period of relative stasis as far as legal regulation of psychiatry is concerned. In contrast, the ethical challenges that we face seem to be growing around us, and much of that is driven by advances in technology for diagnosis and treatment of psychiatric disorders. Part of what I spend my time doing these days is running a center that focuses on the ethical, legal, and social implications of advances in genetics. Particularly, we're interested in psychiatric and behavioral genetics, and the potential for the availability, which we're not there yet, but you can see it looming down the road, the availability of predictive and diagnostics genetic testing for psychiatric disorders raises all kinds of concerns about, for example, the impact on patients of being told there's something in their genes that makes them the way they are, and the impact that has, for example, on their optimism about treatment, willingness to engage in treatment, the impact on families who are now being told, well, you gave this in some sense to your children. We're back to this model of intergenerational transfer that somehow predisposes people to schizophrenia. Those are all concerns that we as a profession are going to be dealing with pretty soon.
Now, I guess one thing that I've been curious about in this is, there's a lot of discussion about the implications of genetics, and certainly 10 years ago or 20 years ago, the idea that, well, we're going to be able to sort of have this deterministic idea. We know the DNA, and we now know for sure that whether or not you're going to develop schizophrenia or not. But it seems like there's much more it doesn't seem like in many areas we've been able to do much better than we could have already done with a family history. And what's unique about the genetic potential? Why is that different than what we've known for a long time, that a lot of these things are somewhat heritable, some of them more than others?
So I think it's important to underscore that today, for almost every disorder, family history is still a better predictor of risk than genetic testing would be. But as we anticipate the development of, for example, polygenic risk scores that will allow for more accurate prediction, what's different is that people perceive genetic predispositions to be something different because it's they envision it as embedded in their genes, embedded in their cells, embedded in their bodies. The field talks about genetic essentialism as a notion that genetic information is different than other kinds of information. It feels more part of you. It feels more intrinsic, less malleable, perhaps less susceptible to treatment, and people tend to have very complex relations to that. Now, as your question suggests, many of those perceptions are inaccurate, in that no psychiatric disorders are entirely, none of our common disorders are entirely determined genetically. And environmental influences, the things we go through in our lives, play an enormous role. And I think many of the challenges we face will be ameliorated ultimately by a better understanding among the public and among clinicians about the implications of genetic predispositions. But that's work for the field still to do.
I'd imagine from a legal perspective also additionally complicated in terms of something like culpability or...
Yes, yeah, so we're beginning to see, and have been for perhaps the past decade, the growing introduction over time of behavioral genetic and psychiatric genetic evidence in court. Typically these days in death penalty cases, typically at the sentencing stage, and typically as part of an argument that this particular person who by now has been convicted of committing a murder, a capital offense, is less culpable for the behavior and therefore should not be sentenced to death but should be given life in prison, the typical alternative sentence, by virtue of his genetic predisposition to act in an impulsive way or an aggressive way, which made it harder for him to control his behavior than it would be for anyone else. Now, those arguments have a mixed history in the law because the most common legal response to those kinds of arguments is to say, you come with the predisposition you come with, and if it's a little harder for you to control your behavior, well, then you should work harder to do it. Nonetheless, particularly the capital defense bar has been turning to genetic testing along with neuroimaging and neuropsychological testing to try to persuade juries that are faced with these sentencing dilemmas that this information should be construed as mitigating and their client should be spared the death penalty. And we'll see this filter down into less severe criminal charges as well.
And I guess, again, this is a parallel question to the earlier one, but it would seem to me, I mean, has this been used in the law previously to say, well, you know, the person had a difficult childhood, that there was abuse, and so that's why, you know, we know that that leads to impulsivity, and so I guess, again, this is just another strand of things that can reduce culpability?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's absolutely true that bad childhoods, suffering child abuse, growing up in poverty, poor education have all been raised as mitigating conditions as well. And when you think about it carefully, there shouldn't be a reason for genetic information to be treated differently. And yet it seems to be perceived differently in many cases.
As more authoritative?
As more deterministic. Hmm. That somehow you can overcome your bad childhood, but you can't overcome your genes. And even though that is a fallacious piece of reasoning, it is an appealing one to many people.
That sounds very much Francis Crick, astonishing hypothesis-y.
Yes, well, the public has been, subjected to language for decades now about how your life is inscribed in the code in your DNA, which suggests a very deterministic view, which is unrealistic, but nonetheless, I think it's become fairly deeply embedded in our society.
Mm. Yeah, and that one, I don't know if I've talked to a few people at Stanford, and they talk about sampling the genome of the brain and how there's some emerging evidence that the genome of one neuron is not identical to the genome of the neighboring neuron. Have you heard about this? And if that's true, if it turns out to be that there are variants in brain DNA, what would that mean for the kind of the ethical implications?
Yeah, we still have to figure out as a field what the dimensions of that mosaicism are in the brain. It does, at least based on the few data that are out there, seem to be a real phenomenon. It certainly will complicate both the development of predictive testing as well as these kinds of arguments that were talking about with regard to assessing the impact of genetic predispositions on responsibility. So now the question becomes not, do you carry this allele, but in what percentage of your relevant neurons is this allele actually activated? It suggests we're just beginning to fathom the complexity of this.
It says a lot about people's desire to have like a direct causality for something. Like, we can't just give you a diagnosis in the DSM or our assessments as a psychiatrist like aren't good enough. We need this genetic proof to say, well, that's why they did it or that's what happened.
Yeah, there's something tangible about a genetic finding that doesn't seem tangible in the same way about saying this person has a history of child abuse or suffered sexual abuse as a young person, and that has shaped their entire lives. Somehow it's easier to point to a genetic finding as playing a causal role than it is to what in all likelihood is a much more formative and influential experience in their lives.
It sort of bespeaks our implicit materialism that, things that we can physically touch or see in a microscope are really real.
Yeah.
And I suppose the same thing happens in neuroimaging. Ah, look, it's a pretty brain picture. That's real. But whatever you were talking about before, abuse or whatever, that's not really real unless I could see it on a brain scan.
Yeah. Now, we should, to balance this off, note that although it's clear many people feel that way, studies that have looked in sort of laboratory settings, because it's hard to do this in courtrooms, at the extent to which neuroimaging data, there's one body of studies about those, and genetic data, second body of studies about those, actually are likely to influence sentencing decisions or decisions about guilt or innocence. Those studies tend to show that people often discount the scientific information in favor of focusing on the characteristics of the crime itself or the person's past history and whether this represents a repetitive pattern of behavior. So we have to be careful, I think, that the studies show that their attitudes towards the defendant and about the defendant change, but there's still the impulse to treat the crime as a serious event that requires serious retribution.
That's interesting. So the implicit assumption of the of people, I guess the general public, continues to be this assumption that there is some degree of free will or ability to choose or ability to have done otherwise but that in addition to that, that you can, you know, increase or decrease culpability based on these other factors on a second analysis.
Yeah, and it's a little hard to argue that that's a coherent view taken as a whole. If I tell you somebody has a genetic predisposition to something or a brain function abnormality that showed up on fMRI, and you tell me that that reduces his responsibility for his behavior, and yet that doesn't appear to influence the ultimate disposition that you settle on, the length of sentence, or, you know, whether or not the death penalty is imposed. It looks as though, and, you know, we and others are still trying to work out what's exactly going on with these findings. It looks as though the punitive impulse, the retributive impulse, the sense that if somebody did something bad, they should be punished, overrides even the sense that mitigating factors may diminish their level of responsibility.
I guess I wonder then, like, with that in mind, what do you think this desire to attribute the current president's actions to mental health or neurologic disease, where does that come from? I know that as a psychiatrist and also a legal expert, you have thought a lot about what our role in this is and what our allowed role in this is. But I think it's interesting when you're saying, like, well, we want behaviors and punishment, but yet attributing a disease to it does seem to mitigate it in some way.
Well, as you suggested earlier, people are attracted to concrete explanations of complex phenomena. They like to hear there's a gene for something that explains it, and put explains in quotes. I think the same is true in the political realm when there's behavior that they perceive as inexplicable in ways that they're familiar with. They would like to put a label on it, and psychiatry offers a slew of diagnostic labels that are sitting out there waiting to be appropriated. I've been very perplexed and disturbed by the frequency with which our colleagues are willing to offer public diagnoses of the president and other candidates and other public figures, without ever having examined them, as if they could authoritatively reach that judgment without really sitting down, learning about a person, learning their history, getting honest answers to the questions that they're posing, and ruling out alternative possibilities. It's not been a pretty picture in many respects.
And this calls into question this Goldwater rule. Can you explain that a little bit and
sure,
how that fits in?
Sure. So in the 1964 election, a magazine publisher, Ralph Ginsberg, published an issue of his magazine, which was called Fact Magazine, largely by way of exclusion, which is to say it had everything but facts in it. He sent out a survey to the members of the American Psychiatric Association. There were about 12,000 back then. Somewhere over 1,000 responded, and he published excerpts from their responses with regard to whether they thought the Republican candidate that year, Barry Goldwater, was psychologically fit to be president. And many of those responses would, you know, make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. A variety of diagnoses were assigned, from psychosis to personality disorder to homosexuality, which was considered to be a psychiatric disorder back then. And Goldwater was very upset. Obviously, he lost the election, not because of Fact Magazine, but after the fact, as it were. He sued Ralph Ginsberg and won a judgment that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. The whole episode was an enormous embarrassment for psychiatry, and pointed out the downsides of psychiatrists reaching judgments like this about public figures and talking about it to the media. Harm to the person themselves. Goldwater later described just how upsetting this whole thing was to him. Dissuading other people who might need psychiatric treatment from coming to treatment. and the diminution of the profession in the eyes of the public by virtue of being perceived as a group of people who are willing to shoot from the hip based on very little information at all. And so some years later, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association adopted what's come to be called the Goldwater Rule, which says that psychiatrists should not be making statements to the media, public statements, with regard to figures in the light of public attention, on whom they haven't conducted an evaluation and from whom they don't have consent to talk about them publicly. I think it's a valuable rule, but obviously in this last election cycle and continuing today, much violated.
It seems like it's been kind of dormant and not talked about for a while, and then like there's a resurgence right now.
You know, we tend to see this every 4 years, because every 4 years during the election cycle, and really going back at least to 1964, somebody thinks one of those candidates represents a threat to truth, justice, and the American way, or maybe even the survival of the republic, and that only by speaking out and telling the world what their psychiatric diagnosis is, can we save the United States of America.
Because no one with a psychiatric illness could lead the country.
Right. as if, you know, Abraham Lincoln didn't have recurrent depression and you know, many other presidents may or may not have had psychiatric disorders as well, as if having a psychiatric disorder were incompatible with being an effective leader. And so dormancy is a relative phenomenon in this case. And, you know, I predict, however our current situation resolves, we're going to be back having this discussion again 4 years from now.
And I think we are running a little low on time now. So I think we'll ask our guests a few rapid-fire questions toward the end. And so if you could answer in one or two sentences, Max, the next questions.
I'll do my best. Goes against my personality, but I'll try.
So the first question is, what is something that psychiatry as a field right now is getting wrong? What's an area that they can improve in? What is something that we can learn to do better?
Well, you know, I think we don't listen to our patients very well today. That part of what we lost in the transition from the era of psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy to the era of psychopharmacology is the ability to sit with patients and listen to their stories and understand what their lives are about. I think we could do better.
That's a good thing to think about. What's your favorite book?
My favorite book? Wow. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember reading Penrod, which I thought was by Booth Tarkington, about a young kid in Indiana growing up there. And I just thought that was a wonderful, wonderful story and a great way to pull kids into reading more. I'll confess to never having read War and Peace, although I did see the movie. So let's leave it with Penrod.
What advice would you give to a young doctor?
I would say that your life is going to be a life of learning. If you went into medicine thinking you could learn a skill and then use it for the next 40 years, you're wrong. Your professional activities are going to change enormously over the course of your lifetime. Acknowledge it, accept it, and prepare for it by trying to learn as much as you can forever.
It's interesting in what you were talking about with the changes to technology, but also there's the changes to like boundaries because of Google and Facebook and other social media places. I just wanted briefly just to hear kind of what your thoughts on that were ethically. Is it okay for us to be Googling our patients?
Yeah, so I think we're moving to a world in which our patients' electronic footprints are going to become part of the treatment process. I hope it's a world that we move to consensually, which is to say with patients' agreement. All kinds of tools are being developed and tested now for monitoring, using smartphones, for example, to monitor patients' location, activity levels, sleep, mood, by having them several times a day log in and report what their mood states are. It'll give us a depth of information we never had before. Can't do it without patients' cooperation. I think that kind of alliance will be critical. It's one of the ways psychiatric practice will change in the next 10 to 20 years.
Would be, I would say, in the office, I'm going to Google you, and you would know that I was doing that, and that'd be okay?
Well, so Googling, which in a sense is a 20th century issue almost, because we're prepared to move so far beyond that with our ongoing monitoring of patients. Non-consensual Googling is not a yes or no issue, in my view. There are circumstances. You've got an uncooperative patient in the emergency room who won't tell you anything and who seems to be incredibly distraught, and you know nothing about them. It would be very hard to fault an emergency psychiatrist who didn't Google that patient to see if they could find something, a contact, a family member, something, to tell them more. Indeed, one could see that becoming a standard of care for emergency situations. On the other hand, ongoing treatment patient, relatively stable, you get curious about them and think, gee, I wonder what kind of house they live in, or patient says something about some job they had in the past. You think, gee, that sounds like an interesting story. Let me go online and see if I could find it. That's a much less justifiable use of the capacity we have now to probe people's digital phenotypes, if you will.
Yeah.
And last question, who is somebody who is a hero of yours, either from fiction or history?
Ah, that's good. I admire Dorothea Dix. Dorothea Dix was a Cambridge, Massachusetts school teacher who became interested in large numbers of people with mental illness. This is the early 19th century, who were being confined in jails and almshouses, and went around the country documenting this and going to state legislatures and persuading them to establish state hospitals to care for people. And back then, state hospitals were places of hope, not warehouses. She was a remarkable person.
Well, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.